Andrew Gillum and Bill Nelson hold four-point leads over their Republican challengers, but not everyone in Florida has gone out yet to vote. Have you? Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Just ahead, where the races stand in Florida one day before the election, the most expensive midterm election ever. Give us a call now as we look at the latest numbers one day before the final tally is made. Call us up now, 549-2937. Then later, expanding the use of body cameras here for local police, plus singer Amy Ray and Cole Pepper on the Jaguars. They're at the midpoint in the season, and they've got a lot of ground to make up. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, a new NBC Marist poll out today shows Democrats hold slim leads in Florida's pivotal statewide races in the final push to Tuesday's midterm elections. Now, in the Senate race, incumbent Democrat Bill Nelson leads Republican Governor Rick Scott by 4 points. Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, the same. He leads his challenger, former Republican Congressman Ron DeSantis, by 4 points. Early voting is over, and it has been robust. Tomorrow is your final chance to get out and vote. And of course, it's not over until tomorrow night when everyone has voted. Although the Democrats are leading, we have learned over the years in Florida never to second guess the results until the final ballot is counted. Here to provide some insights and read some tea leaves for us, we welcome back to Studio 5 one of our most valued contributors, Matt Corrigan, with UNF's Political Science Department. Matt, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being here. Did you vote early out there, everybody, or are you waiting till Election Day? Who do you think is going to win these elections? And do you see these midterm elections, as I said, the most expensive midterms ever, as a referendum on the president, or are you more concerned with Florida issues? Give us a call, 549-2937, or email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Send tweets to @MelissaInJax. Okay, Matt, let's begin with this new NBC Marist poll. The last one to come out, it looks like, before the election here in Florida, showing both Bill Nelson and Andrew Gillum enjoying 4-point leads over their challengers, Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis. However, it's not over, as I said, until everybody votes, and we have yet to see how independent, no party affiliated voters will factor in this race. That's always such a big part of elections in Florida.
Yeah, essentially what the early voting and the vote by mail numbers are showing. And again, for your listeners, we don't know how these people voted. We just know their party affiliation. So the ones who have voted already, it's essentially tied between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats have a slight lead statewide, just in terms of return ballots. Again, we don't know results, just if they voted or not. And that's a relatively big deal for Democrats because Election Day voters tend to skew heavily Republican. So Democrats need to build up somewhat of a cushion before Election Day. So, but if you just look at the bigger picture, if you've got basically the same number of Democrats and the same number of Republicans voting, then it all falls on the NPAs, no party affiliation and independents. If Democrats stay with Democrats and Republicans stay with Republicans, I think Democrats are hoping for some crossover voting. We'll see.
Right. But how many Republicans might actually do that?
Right.
I think Democrats might be engaging in a little bit of wishful thinking on that.
But, you know, this is Florida. And, for example, in our last governor's race, you're only talking about a difference of about 65,000 votes, you know, and that's nothing in the state of Florida. And so, a couple percentage point difference makes a big deal. Right now, if polling is accurate, at least in terms of trends, I know everyone remembers 2016, so I'm not focusing on percentages. I'm just looking at trends. And there right now, there's a huge gap in MPAs going for Gillum, and it looks like going for Nelson over the Republican candidates. And if that gap stays there, Democrats are gonna win on Tuesday. Usually, the MPAs and independents are very close because they're a lot that they can be described in lots of different ways, and they don't really vote on one particular issue. For example, in 2016, Donald Trump won MPAs here in Florida by 4 percentage points, which isn't a big number. But again, Democrats needed help with the MPAs to win the state, and they didn't get it. Right now, it looks like they're getting it.
And what do you think's driving that, this swing away from the Republicans, NPA voters here in Florida? You know, they've gone Republican the last couple of cycles, or they certainly went Republican in 2016.
Well, again, they went Republican, but not by a huge margin. And here it looks like they're going Democratic by huge margins. And again, it's a great political science question that we need to do more research on independents in Florida. But I think it's all over the place. One, I think it's anti-Trump. Two, I think the environmental issues have really had an impact in this race, and I think is hurting both the incumbent governor and Rick DeSantis, and I think that's a major part of it as well. And then when you look at the gun issue, I think maybe for the first cycle in maybe history, or at least recent history, you know, gun regulation is a better position to be than pro NRA.
Let's talk about what's at stake here in Florida. If Andrew Gillum, Florida's first black gubernatorial candidate, is victorious, he will seek to really reshape the way the state governs and spends. He wants an expansion of federal and state Medicaid insurance for low-income people. He wants teachers to be paid $50,000 a year. He wants to raise the corporate tax rate to pay for all this. That's going to be heavy, tough sledding with the Republican-led state house. And then at the same time, should Nelson eke out a win over Rick Scott, that could play a role in Democrats potentially, although it's a very high hill to climb, retaking a slim majority in the Senate. And that would limit the president's ability to push his legislative priorities through Congress. So there's a lot at stake here on this ballot, Matt. And, you know, it's fascinating to watch the way the entire nation is so closely following, particularly this Florida governor's race.
No. I think it's a positive sign for our democracy that there's so much interest in a midterm election. Usually there's not. And you know, midterms a lot of times get short attention spans from voters, but this year it's everyone's focused on it, and that has to do with Trump. I mean, he's said it himself. He's putting his name on the ballot. He's had a very controversial tenure. The economy's going really well, so that's in the Republicans' favor.
But that's certainly in the favor of Ron DeSantis and Rick Scott.
Right, but the problem with the president, you've seen in midterms before this, the incumbent president picks their spots. And, you know, there are certain states that, you know, an incumbent president's really going to help you. But there are other districts where he's not going to help you. Trump can't control himself. I mean, he just dominates the media, which, of course, got him elected. So, in some ways, I understand that that's why he's doing that. But he just can't control himself. And so his message goes into districts and to states that's not helpful for Republicans. And I think that's the real question nationwide. If Gillum does pull out this, you know, remarkable win, which it would be remarkable, is that part of a trend going nationwide? Because Florida tends to be, a trendsetter.
Let's go to your calls now. One day before the election, have you voted? Do you plan to wait till Tuesday? What's driving your vote? 549-2937. Janet is on the South Side. Hi, Janet. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I took advantage of the early voting, and my motivation was definitely a rejection of Trump and his policies. I am concerned about health care. I'm about to go on Medicare myself, but I'm still concerned about health care for other people in Florida. And recreational marijuana wasn't bad either. So I voted no against all the judges appointed by Rick Scott. And go Gillum, go Bill Nelson. I think we got this.
Okay, that's a Democratic voter, certainly. Janet on the South Side, thanks for that. As she mentioned, health care. Democrats have pushed that message hard in Florida, trying to motivate voters to come out to the polls to protect coverage of pre-existing conditions. Is that something that will be or decisive, or do you think a major factor this time?
Yeah, that's been the Democratic message. If Democrats have one unifying message, it's been healthcare. And boy, have times changed.
In 2 short years.
Well, in 2010, what brought Republicans to power in Congress was running against Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And now, really, some of those protections are the Democrats' best political weapon, and President Obama must be sitting back saying, "Well, you know, what the world has happened?"
I know, it's extraordinary. I mean, in a few years, candidates have gone from defending their vote to push for coverage for pre-existing conditions, to Republicans now on the defensive for voting to take away pre-existing conditions. The American voters have decided we like this aspect of the Affordable Care Act.
Right. And if I could comment on another thing that she said is, you know, Democrats got this. No, they don't. Not yet. And because Election Day is going to be a big Republican day, most likely, unless, you know, patterns change, because you have a lot of super voter traditionalist Republicans who only want to vote on Election Day. Professor Dan Smith and from University of Florida in Gainesville did research on last Election Day, and Republicans won the state by about 12 percentage point on that day. And again, I know I'm throwing a lot of numbers out there. Obviously, you lump in Election Day numbers to the early voting numbers, and that's the final outcome. But yes, Democrats have very good trends going into Election Day. But if Republicans just blow it out like they did in 2016, you know, we're looking at another really close race, or we're looking at a Republican victory.
Let's go to some more calls. 549-2937. Marcel is on the South Side. Hi, Marcel. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to say I voted Saturday. The lines were, at least at the district I voted in, the line was huge. One voter actually came in frustration and actually screamed out, I've never seen a midterm this bad in my life. She said she'd been there like to three other midterms before. I got to say, a lot of colorful people were voting. It was really nice to see all that. And I can only imagine that Tuesday, the lines are probably going to be even much longer. So I think everybody's coming out for sure to vote this midterm, and I think you guys are going to see either a tight race, or it's going to be pretty. It's going to be, you know, a lot of people. The numbers are going to be pretty big. I don't know if it's due to all the text messages and robocalls everybody's been getting, but it seems like a lot more people are coming out.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I agree, Marcel. Really good turnout. And I think you tweeted out, Matt, over the weekend, the Duval County Democrats have really tried to run up the score so as to try to act as a bulwark against a big Republican turnout tomorrow. All the big urban counties in Florida, it seems that's been their strategy for the Democrats anyway.
Right. And a shout out to, I think the Democrats' ground game so far, it's been really good. And just for in terms of comparison, in Duval in 2014, Rick Scott won Duval by over 30,000 votes. That was half of his margin of victory in the state. That's not going to happen this time. I don't know if Democrats are going to win Duval, but really they've accomplished what they need to accomplish and made it really close. And unless, again, there's a huge Election Day wave for Republicans. And so that's been accomplished. The question is, Duval was close in 2016, and Trump and Republicans found votes elsewhere in the state, especially the central part of the state and some of those suburban and exurban counties.
Let's go to Helen in Orange Park. Hi, Helen. Thanks for holding. Good morning, Helen. Go ahead.
I voted, I guess, almost 2 weeks ago. And I voted for anybody that Trump supported. I like what Trump has done, and I don't like his presentation, but I like the fact that he's tried and he's, with all that is against him, has accomplished. I think it's a shame that he's not a president of We the People, because half of us won't support or do anything or go along with him. And I'm just almost ashamed of the way our country is split into two.
Yeah. Thanks,
but
Helen.
Anyways,
thanks for that. And yeah. And so I really appreciate you sharing that. And so Helen, and we went from a Democratic caller to a Republican caller, and you see from Helen, she's motivated to turn out because she feels the need to defend President Trump and support Republican candidates as a way to send a message of support.
Right. And the DeSantis campaign will be the ultimate experiment for that, because obviously DeSantis wrapped himself under Trump's cape, if you will. You know, he ran that famous commercial where he was reading Trump's book to his kids and so forth. And so he's cast his lot with the president. And so we'll see how he does. And again, you know, a lot of Republicans I talk to say, you know, listen, forget the polls. There's a silent majority out there that will support Trump. It happened in 2016. So we'll see. You know, again, we've got to wait for all the data to come in. And but DeSantis is the test case for that.
Yeah, for sure. Jerry in St. Augustine. Hi, Jerry. How are you?
I am doing great this morning. I am about to turn 70 years old, and I have been voting Republican since I was 18. And about 2 months ago, I changed my affiliation to NPA because I am so disgusted with what's going on in the Republican Party. So I can tell you that the leadership in the White House would totally turn me off against being a Republican, being affiliated with that. So you can imagine how I voted.
So you went Dem this time?
I was in on the second day of early election.
First time you voted Democrat?
Basically, yes.
Okay. Yeah, Jerry, thanks for that. I appreciate that call. Okay, so now we've heard in a row from a Democrat, a Republican, and an NPA voter. Florida in a nutshell, Matt.
Sure. And, you know, again, because Trump has dominated the media landscape so much, you know, in a way that's overshadowed other issues here in the state. And, you know, in some ways, I'm concerned about that because we need our voters paying attention to what's going on in the state. But in the other another way to look at it is if Democrats do have a big day, it is a check on the presidency. And that's the whole idea behind the House of Representatives voting every 2 years.
And Democrats want to pick up a net 23 seats in the House to win a majority. If they do that, they will have the chance then to conduct what they see as more appropriate oversight over this president. You know, hearing Jerry, the NPA voter, saying, you know, I'm 70 years old and this is the first time I voted, or one of the first times I voted Democrat. It's like you said a minute ago, there's not a lot of polling and not a lot of data about voters like Jerry out there that people like you can track. And you hear anecdotal stories like his, but it's really hard to get a finger on whether that's going to be a big block of voters that are doing what he did.
Well, yeah, the NPAs can, you know, represent disaffected Republicans who've switched. Also, I'm seeing some reports that newly arrived Puerto Ricans are establishing themselves as NPAs, and that might have an impact. So, again, some of the early counties will tell us if these trends are going to hold up.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with UNF's Matt Corrigan as an NBC Marist poll out today finds here in Florida, a swing state survey, Andrew Gillum, the Democratic candidate for governor, and Bill Nelson seeking to keep his seat in the Senate, also a Democrat, each hold 4-point leads over their challengers, Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis. However, as Matt has been pointing out, that poll is not by any means decisive because many people have yet to vote tomorrow. Where are you going to vote? Have you voted already? What are your thoughts about this midterm election, the most expensive in American history? Billions of dollars spent. Alex is on the north side. Hi, Alex. Good morning.
Hey, we also got many members of our family out to our Florida. They flipped from liberals to Republicans because they see the great economy. They were threatening themselves with their companies being closed and being moved to Mexico. And thanks to the economy policies of President Trump, this company decided to stay in the United States. They got an increase on salary, plus they got a bonus. So I'm so glad our family flipped to Republican vote.
Okay. Thanks, Alex. Thanks for that.
And I really think that's the summary. If if tomorrow is a big day for Democrats, and we don't know that yet, but that those are some of the trends that, that may indicate that. I think the missed argument here is the economy is doing really well. You know, in Florida, you can always look at, you know, service workers and workers who aren't making enough. And I mean, there's obviously problems there, but the overall economy is doing really well. But the president just won't focus on that. I mean, it's a new issue every day. It's a caravan at the border. It's, you know, what's the intrigue going on in the West Wing? And because he dominates the media landscape, you get the good for that for Republicans, but you also get the bad for that. And they should have been talking about the economy the whole time.
You think, yeah. You know, Matt, people should just listen to Matt Corrigan more broadly. That's always been my view when it comes to politics. They should just listen to you. But these guys often think they know better. Okay, here's an email from Andy. I'm not counting any chickens until tomorrow night, but it is my hope that we can place a muzzle on the mad dog Trump. Ouch, he says, by at least taking the House. And I also wish to send Rick Scott to his cushy Florida retirement. Well, Andy, we will see whether you get your wish or not. We just don't know yet. And here's a tweet from Josh. It seems like the result rests on how NPAs are breaking and then turn out on Election Day. A good question is, how do those Election Day voters compare in ideology and enthusiasm against early voters? We'll see. But, you know, the early vote has been pretty enthusiastic. The turnout has been, what, twice as high as we normally see in a midterm, Matt, or close to it?
Yeah. Well, again, I think early voting is becoming a lot more accepted as we go from election to election. You remember the rules in Florida used to be you could only do an absentee ballot if you were sick or worker.
Right.
You know, and so some of these comparisons to 2008 and 2012, we just didn't do it as often as we do now. So it's a little hard to make some of those comparisons. Mm-hmm. But his question on election day voters versus early day voters, from what we know from 2016, it was a big Republican day, election day, not in aggregate, but election day. And that's what won Trump Florida. And so, again, I think Democrats are excited to see some of these numbers, but do they have a turnout operation for Election Day so they don't get completely swamped on Election Day? You know, our supervisor of elections does a great job of providing this early voting data and Election Day data as it happens. So you can track how Republicans are doing in Duval on Election Day. And you're going to see a Republican lead on Election Day. Again, not the aggregate vote, but on Election Day. The question is, how big a lead is that going to be? And is that going to be enough to counteract what Democrats have already done and NPAs as well?
Let's take one more call. It's Lily at the Beaches. Hello, Lily. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to let you know that my vote was cast with the intent of trying to bring back honesty and integrity into politics, because there's been so little, if any, of it. And also, I'd like to say that I wish that even half of the money that goes into campaigns would be put into cities for all of the people, whether it's infrastructure or helping the needy.
Sure. Thanks. Yes. And I'm sure so many agree with you, Lily. The amount of money spent here is just mind blowing. A billion spent around the country in all these races. Rick Scott alone, to try to unseat Bill Nelson, Matt, has spent $70 million of his own money.
Right. And this is the second time he's done that.
And the second time he's done it.
And that's just an amazing amount. And I was wondering, you know, why the DeSantis campaign wasn't attacking Gillum earlier, you know, in September. That it dawned on me, they don't have the pocketbook that Rick Scott does. And so, you know, it makes a big difference if you can pour this in. And that's why this Scott Nelson race is so interesting. Because, I mean, Scott's putting $70 million, but Nelson's the incumbent. You know, you could argue if somebody's spending $7 million against you, you're not going to have a chance. Nelson's clearly still competitive. But at the end of it, you know, Rick Scott has clearly played to the independents. If you've seen his commercials, a grandfather, a hurricane manager, etc. Whereas Ron DeSantis has run a much more Trumpian campaign. Mm-hmm. Let's see which one pays off, if either.
Let's make a quick note of the fact that our own Jacksonville treasurer, Matt Corrigan, will be in Miami tomorrow night helping the Associated Press call the election. I did not know you were going to be doing this. Fascinating. Can you explain quickly before we let you go what that involves?
Sure. As the data comes in, I don't make the final call, but what I do is I look at the numbers coming in and give them an idea of what I think's happening. And then they take that information from the Miami Bureau and check with their Washington people, and then they make a final call of the election.
Always good to get your insights. Have fun down there. I'm sure it'll be an interesting night.
Thanks, Melissa.
And of course, we'll be live here on 89.9 and live on Facebook, too, tomorrow night, starting at 7 and as the polls close. Much more still to come. We'll be right back.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the memory of Fred Rogers with the 16th annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped off at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union branches, Two Men in a Truck, and the Tom Bush family of dealerships. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area. Do you have a story to tell? Since 2003, StoryCorps has been collecting and archiving stories from all over the country. From November 18th to December 21st, StoryCorps will be right here in Jacksonville. StoryCorps is the two-time Peabody Award-winning nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and share humanity's stories. If you've ever listened to their NPR program, you know how powerful and touching these stories can be. To find out how StoryCorps can record your story, go to wjct.org/events. Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, today in Jacksonville, the state attorney's office is hosting University of South Carolina professor Seth Stoughton. Stoughton is giving a presentation on body cameras. Now, of course, body cameras for police officers have become a flashpoint of debate in recent years due to a series of incidents often caught on video all over the country involving a shooting of an unarmed person of color. The idea is that body cameras can improve accountability and protect police as well. This session today comes as JSO has recently begun piloting the use of the cameras and talking more about how to implement them. Lots to get into here. Seth Stoughton of USC, that's University of South Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning.
Give us a call. What are your thoughts about body cameras for police? It's 549-2937. Okay. This really blew up about 4 years ago after Ferguson, Missouri, and then some other incidents. Activists all over the country, including here in Jacksonville, are demanding that police wear body cameras. Sheriff Mike Williams has been open to the idea and wants to pilot the idea. You're an expert on body cameras and their potential benefits and risks. So what are we going to learn today from your presentation?
Well, the single most important thing that we're going to learn is that body cameras are a tool. And just like a hammer is good for some things and not good for other things, so too body cameras will be good in some cases and not very good in other cases. So the goal of today's presentation is to remind people to have realistic expectations about the potential of this tool to improve accountability, to capture relevant and valuable evidence. In some cases, it's going to be great. In other cases, maybe not. And in some cases, it may be affirmatively unhelpful. We may actually get misleading information from body cameras.
What would be an incident like that where you feel a body camera would be actually detrimental to a good outcome?
So in certain use of force situations, for example, which of course are right at the top of the list of the incidents that we want reliable evidence on, body cameras may not provide the evidence that we want. Use of force situation when an officer goes hands-on with a community member is often at very close range, and that means the body camera, the camera itself, may only be a matter of inches, maybe 16, 18 inches from the person upon whom force is used, so it's not going to capture a lot of information.
So logistical things can get in the way sometimes.
Absolutely. Okay. Logistical things, and also our own human ability to interpret body camera footage. We're not very good about interpreting movement on video for a couple of different reasons. When we move, our brains, which are hardwired to our bodies, are pretty good about translating the information that it gets into data that makes sense to us.
It's fascinating, though, as your research shows, across the country, 95% of the police agencies that have been surveyed about this, both police and sheriff's associations, 95% say they're going to implement body cameras or are looking to implement body cameras.
I don't know that we've ever seen a piece of technology expand through policing as rapidly as body cameras have. With the last, we've had cameras for a while. We've had dash cameras, in-car camera systems since the late 80s. But that took almost 20 years to get to more than 50% of agencies using them or interested in them. Body cameras, in contrast, have just exploded.
And do you attribute that to the controversy really driven by social media of so many videos that have been uploaded and shared by individuals with their own cell phone cameras capturing these flashpoint violent incidents? That's been the catalyst. Now that everyone has a camera in their hand, that's really what's driving it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The controversial incidents have pushed community members and elected officials and even police executives, police chiefs and sheriffs, to demand body cameras. But I think also in that equation is the fact that we all have body cameras. We all have mobile cameras now. So there's a sense in policing of making sure that the officers themselves have the same equipment that any community member does.
Now, you're giving a presentation today before prosecutors, before State Attorney Melissa Nelson and her staff. Are police going to be at this? And media will be there as well. But this is primarily for prosecutors?
It's primarily for prosecutors, yes. There'll be, I believe the sheriff is going to be there. There may be some police officials and union officials. But it's primarily for the folks who are going to be reviewing this footage, because they need to understand that what you see is not always what you get, or what you think you see is not always what you get with body camera footage.
Let's go to Robert in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Robert, good morning.
Good morning. I'm a retired federal law enforcement officer. Admittedly, I was in technical surveillance, not in street confrontations. But I do have a question I want to ask about body cameras. Body cameras could be supplemented or augmented by audio. How do you guys feel about that? Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, great question, Robert. And you're absolutely right. So if we break the type of evidence that we get from body cameras into pieces, we get video, of course, but maybe even more important is the audio that we get. Having that audio allows us to interpret, or helps us interpret, what we see on the video itself. So that's important. Also, there will be situations where we don't have video, or we don't have reliable video, like those use of force situations, where we might actually get more value from the audio. For example, whether an officer was yelling verbal commands before or after the sound of gunshots could be a very relevant question, where even if the video itself is not useful, the audio for that video will be.
Now, just the other day, JSO confirmed that the first phase of their body-worn camera program has started. They're going to train about 200 officers each quarter and then fully roll out the program over the next 2 years, you know, teaching officers how to activate and deactivate the cameras, how to store the footage, who can review the recordings. That's been a flashpoint of contention in this city. But it is proceeding in this city. And so that's something you've seen replayed all over America.
Yes, in a bunch of different ways. There are agencies that I think have managed the rollout very well, typically by taking a staged approach so they can learn lessons about body cameras as they're implementing them and then work those lessons into future implementation. I've also seen some agencies not do it particularly well, where they throw body cameras onto officers without a lot of thought about policy or procedure. So I think JSO is taking a little more measured approach here.
And you like that?
I do. I think it's far better to do a slower, better job than it is to rush to put this tool into play without
measure
a good understanding.
Measure twice, cut once. Yeah.
Exactly right.
Daryl in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. I have kind of 2 points. The first is that if you don't put body cameras on there and make this situation much more transparent, you have a choice. Either the police, with putting out the video cameras and the video immediately, will control the story, or people with their own cell phones will control the story. The idea that the information director is going to stand in front of a podium and tell us what happened when there's all kinds of video out there, either in conflict or something, is kind of very, very old school and not really paying attention. The issue in Ferguson, the officer was actually proven to be true and right once that video was out there. But unfortunately, immediately the video of the victim or the person shot laying in the road, an entire firestorm of misinformation was out there before the information director from Ferguson was ever in front of a podium. So the riot was on before the truth was out. So the video camera enables you for body cameras to just say, boom, here's what happened. Here's what it is. We didn't shoot them in the back. Boom. It's proof and prevents that riot before it even starts. So that's the first part. The second part is the idea that you should, officer should be able to turn it off is kind of silly. The $9 an hour cashier doesn't get to turn off the camera when he's making change. Why would we allow an officer who has the right to literally kill a citizen be able to turn the video camera off and on?
Okay, Daryl.
That's just ridiculous.
Thanks for that. Okay, so clearly among some folks out there, there's still a lot of distrust, anger, cynicism about whether these will be used responsibly and objectively. How do you see that as someone who studied this, how agencies can deal with that problem and try to build trust and goodwill as they implement this technology?
Yeah, so one of the values that we get from body cameras, not just better evidence, but also that trust building, that goodwill, that accountability, sometimes it depends more on how you use a tool than whether you have a tool, right? So if I go back to that hammer example, a hammer would be a great way to drive a nail if you used it the correct way. But if you hold it by the head and you try and beat the nail in with the end of the shaft, if you hold it backwards, it's not going to be very good for that job. Body cameras are exactly the same thing. They can help with accountability. They can help build public trust when they're used appropriately. And that may require agencies to think very hard and to collaborate with their community stakeholders about when to release video, how to release video, about policies governing when officers are allowed to or not allowed to turn the cameras on or off. There's no one universal solution. It very much is a matter of local conditions. So I think there's room for variation from agency to agency. But having body cameras does not get you the value. Using them appropriately,
That's
what gets you the value.
Well, this is just a preview of the presentation that Seth Stoughton will give today at the State Attorney's Office. And we so appreciate you sharing your insights with us.
Thank you very much for having
Professor
me.
Professor Seth Stoughton of the University of South Carolina. Later in the hour, Cole Pepper on the Jaguars' midpoint season hopes. But up next, singer Amy Ray. We'll be right back.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free.
Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name that we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
Oh, I love that song. Welcome back. Well, she's one half of the beloved folk rock duo, the Indigo Girls. Remember this song, Closer to Fine? Amy Ray also has some amazing solo work out and a new album, and she's playing the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall this Thursday night. I spoke with Ray about the new music. Take a listen. Amy Ray, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about this new album, Holler. You recorded this in Asheville earlier this year, right?
Yeah, I recorded in Asheville. We recorded to tape. I always try to make my records to tape. And I have a really great band. You know, some of them are from North Carolina and a couple of people from Seattle, Washington, and Georgia. And I've been making records with this band for a while. We've been touring. We made one about 5 years ago, and then we toured for a while off and on, and then we made this. It's kind of an Americana, southern sort of music record. Kind of runs the gamut from gospel to country to sort of punky country stuff. So it's kind of all over the map. But I think it's my seventh solo record, but this one, the last couple I've made have been more country influenced.
And what's headed you in the country direction, do you think?
I think I've always been into that kind of music. I just think I had, when I first started making solo records, I was collaborating with a lot of punk rock people, and that's sort of the direction I was in. And then maybe I live in the rural area of North Georgia, and had moved up here about 25 years ago, and it definitely started getting into my music to be up here and where there's a lot of bluegrass players and a lot of country music and sort of mountain music and traditional music up here.
And you've still got so many fans from your time as one half of the Indigo Girls. So how do you bring those fans along as you've sort of changed your sound a little bit over the years?
Well, I'm still playing. Indigo Girls are still going strong. So we tour all the time, and we came out with a symphony record last year. And so, you know, those fans, you know, when I'm playing with Emily, I'll kind of play some of the solo songs too, and Emily will play some of her solo songs. And so we sort of get the word out all the time about what we're doing on the side. And, you know, some of those fans like what I'm doing solo and some of them don't. Mm-hmm. You know, it just depends on, I mean, so I just kind of, I guess I've just been building an audience of people that, you know, are interested in this particular thing that I'm doing. And every time I kind of do a solo project, I have to kind of start over again and let people know about it. But it's a labor of love, you know, and I just do it because I love doing projects on the side, and I love touring in smaller venues and driving around in a van and kind of being the whole process, you know, of being an independent artist and kind of on, you know, lower echelon of things. I just like it, you know, so it's really just for fun. And I love the band that I play with. They're really good players and they're fun to be with, and we always just have a great time at the show. So it's kind of just another thing that I do. But Indigo's, you know, we're making a new record in January, and we're just still out there playing all the time, actually.
Excellent. Well, that's good to hear. And we're excited to have you come to town. That's November 8th, Amy Ray with Daniel Hall at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall to promote her new album, Holler. Amy Ray, I've been a fan for years, so it's really good to talk to you on the phone, and have a great show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Amy Ray and band with guest Danielle Howell. This Thursday night, November 8th at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. Go see her. And back in a moment with Culpepper.
To the mountains, I look to the children. I drink from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions.
The Florida Council on Economic Education is shining the spotlight on four outstanding business leaders, John Falconetti, Tim Fincham, Nathaniel Ford, and Gary Norcross, at the 20th Annual First Coast Business Hall of Fame on November 16th. Tickets and sponsorship opportunities at fcee.org.
Nemours is not simply a place for care. Nemours is a way of caring for children. Our promise means we'll do whatever is in our power to help children grow up healthy, regardless of ability to pay. You can help. Nemours.org/ourpromise.
Thank you. November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name that we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
The new book, Florida Made, is a ranked list of the 25 most important figures who shaped the state. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with co-author Laura Mize. We'll discuss Detroit, Florida, and talk about the Hard Rock Collection of Memorabilia in Orlando. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
For millions of Americans, this year has felt as politically intense as last year. How might historians mark this moment in our history? On the eve of the midterms, we'll take the long view with America's historian-in-chief, Pulitzer Prize winner Doris Kearns Goodwin, on these turbulent times, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour. So, what's next for the Jaguars as they begin the second half of the season?
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
The Jaguars now at 3-5, not where they hope to be at this point in the year. Cole Pepper is here with his thoughts. Hey, Cole.
Hello, Melissa. Yeah, 3-5 doesn't end their season, but it does not give them much margin for error the rest of the way. I think it's probably going to take 10-6 to get into the playoffs. Maybe 9-7 will sneak you in if you have tiebreakers. But right now, the Jaguars don't look very good on the tiebreaker front. Mm-hmm. So I think they pretty much have to go 7-1 the rest of the way to get in. And they have to really fix two things, or these are big category things to fix. Number one is their offensive identity. They've gotten away from who they want to be and who they think they should be, at least who Doug Marrone thinks they should be. Part of that has been as a result of injuries. Part of it also has been sort of a departure. Doug Marrone, when he was introduced as the head coach, said he would love to just run the ball every single time. That's the kind of coach he wants to be. Mm-hmm. Old school, ground and pound kind of approach. They've put too much on Blake Bortles' shoulders so far this year, with the injury to Leonard Fournette, with some injuries and then the offensive skill position. I think they're doing too much in terms of throwing the football. They need to get back to running the ball, and getting Fournette back could be a big part of that. And if they can recapture their identity, I think that'll help them quite a bit on offense. Defensively, they haven't had injuries to speak of, but they have lost a little bit of trust amongst themselves.
Huh.
The best defenses take care of what they need to do and don't try to make a play that another guy is supposed to make. For some reason this year, guys are trying to make too big of plays. I think part of it is they know that the offense has been struggling and they want to try to make some game-changing play. If they get back to doing what they can do, this defense should be among the best in the National Football
League. Yeah, that's what I keep thinking is there was such fanfare when we kicked off the season.
Forget about fanfare, player fare. The players are saying we want to be a historically great defense.
Yes.
Well, you can only do that if you take care of what you can take care of and not try to take care of what the other guy needs to take care of. So I think some defensive trust issues need to be ironed out. That would seem to be an easier thing to do than the offensive identity. Because they have the players to do it on defense. The good news is the schedule is conducive for them to turn things around. The only real powerhouse offense that they're likely to see the rest of the way is the Pittsburgh Steelers, which we'll see in a couple of weeks on Sunday Night Football. And we'll see where it all goes from there. If there's one word, though, that I would use to best describe Doug Marrone, it's pragmatic. Mm-hmm. He's not a guy who spends a lot of time worried about the overly optimistic thoughts, and he doesn't, dwell and gloss over on the bad. He really is very much about what is really happening. It happened last year when they were doing well, happened this year when they're not doing so well. He's looking at things with that same pragmatic viewpoint as he did when the team was playing well.
There's a story out there right now about this team. It's an ugly story, okay? But the story hasn't ended. You know, we can still control, how the story reads. And we get away, we've got to think long and hard about it. We've got to come back and we've got to figure out, what the story is going to be, on the 2018 team.
And it can start on Sunday in Indianapolis against the Colts, which is the Jaguars' first game after the bye week.
All right. So, you know, you were out last week because of that little trip over to London.
Little jaunt, yeah.
And how was that for you?
Really enjoyed it. It was cold and windy, and obviously the Jaguars didn't play very well. And there were some off-the-field issues they had to contend with as well. But
some arrests?
Some detainments.
Detainments?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't think they called them arrests at the time there in England, but they were detained.
They were detained.
Pending further activity. I will say that it's interesting from the English fans I spoke with over there. They're not looking to have an NFL team. They want more NFL games over there.
But not a team.
And not their own team. And I'm expecting that here in the next couple of months we'll learn that the Jaguars will play a road game and a home game both over there in England next year.
All right. Let's talk college football for a minute. The SEC championship is set. It's Georgia versus Alabama. How are you liking that?
That's exactly what I expected when the season began, and it's the matchup we had in the national championship game last year. Georgia still has to take care of business the rest of the way in order to make that game significant from a national title hunt. This year, they've got three games remaining all at home, games they should win, Auburn, UMass, and Georgia Tech, but they have to take care of business. Alabama has looked amazing. They went to LSU and just laid the smackdown on the third-ranked Tigers over the weekend. They are the dominant team in college football right now.
Okay, before we let you go, let's talk about Florida, Florida State. And by the way, the high school football playoffs coming up.
Yeah, a lot of work for the Gators and Seminoles to do. Florida may be changing quarterbacks. Felipe Franks was benched against Missouri on Saturday. Kyle Trask was put in. Dan Mullen saying he's going to see how it all plays out this week. Florida State has to win out to become bowl eligible. They have to beat Boston College and then the Florida game as well at the end of the year. And as far as high school football is concerned, 21 teams from our area earn postseason berths. I think the best chance for state championships, Trinity Christian in 5A and Reigns in 4A, the defending state champions. Yeah. And I think that Lee and Lake City Columbia also have a chance to make some noise in the 7A category as well.
Go Reigns. Go Trinity Christian. All right.
All of them. Let's get some state championships back to Duval County.
And always good to see you. Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper for all your sports news and notes, and catch him every night on our news partner, Channel 4, the local station. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right. That's our show. And thanks for listening. Michelle Corum is our director. Our theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. And if you missed anything, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8:00. I'm Melissa Ross. This is 89.9. Thanks so much for being part of us this morning. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day and enjoy a little more of the Indigo Girls. Amy Ray playing the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall Thursday night.
Do you blame me? Well, the first two might release you, but the last one sings in me, son. Three hits to the heart's run, and it's poetry in motion. Three hits to the heart's run, and the last one sings in me.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.